Hello, and welcome to the Poetry and English Literature podcast. Thank you very much for rejoining us. If you are indeed rejoining us, and if this is your first time with us, welcome to the Poetry and English Literature podcast. Our ethos here is based on the idea that we'd like to plunge into poems by poets that we don't know a huge amount about. It's an idea which we kind of like, but I suppose from a listener's point of view, you'd have to understand that we're not setting ourselves up as experts on whichever poem or poet we happen to be looking at.
If you're looking for crib notes for your dissertation, you might want to look elsewhere, maybe a book.
So you've just heard the voice there of I'm joined by two people as always, and the first is Rob. Hello, Rob.
Hello there, fellows. How are you?
I'm pretty good. And David.
Yeah. Good evening. Hi, Dan, and hi, Rob.
Hi, mate.
Well, thank you both very much for joining me again. I'm not sure that this is a new section of the pod, but we were just chatting for literally 2 minutes before we started recording, which of course we're doing over Skype. And I thought it might be fun to just have a very quick section where we say something that we've been up to ourselves personally. I don't know whether I've sprung that rather on you, gentlemen.
We're still in lockdown. If you're listening to this in the far-flung future, in some sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland, or you're like the Omega Man, then this was back in a time when we were all still in the pandemic and we're all locked in our houses. So I haven't been doing very much at all. I've been doing a little bit of work. I've got a BBC editing job, so I've been doing a little bit of comedy. And other than that, I've been jogging, keeping fit. That's been good.
Now, Rob, I'm very impressed with this, and I understand you've attained quite a significant jog this very day.
Yeah, I did a 10K this morning over at Friston Forest, which is south coast of England, and between Eastbourne and Brighton. That was good. And I'm doing at least 5K a day, but normally sort of 5 to 10K a day. And I've given up the grog. I've lost a bit of weight, so I'm like feeling on top of the world. It's good. I highly recommend jogging.
Well, I may have to come to you for advice when my moment comes to take on such a new.
And I told you, I'm drinking as well. It's the twin prongs of my living forever plan.
Jolly good show. We'll just be careful of the knees.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm rather regretting, not that I wasn't very interested to hear what you had to say, Rob, but I'm now going to have to put the onus on both David and more importantly myself to say something. So, David, would you want to add a little personal reflection?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just a bit infuriated to hear all that, really. I'm just, it's slightly sickening. While Rob was running around the Friston Forest this morning, I'll tell you what, the thing that's happened to me today, which it's slightly appropriate, I think, actually, given the subject of our podcast today, but I was woken by an absolutely almighty racket from my front garden. It was the sound of magpies. I don't know if you ever heard magpies give their warning call when things are kicking off. But it's like some sort of machine gun.
Wow.
And I didn't sort of get up straight away, but I got up a little bit later on to look out to the front garden. I was greeted with the most macabre sight I've seen out of my front window for some time. There was the remnants of a dead pigeon scattered all over the front garden.
And, not very Ted Hughes.
And a dead rat on the front path leading up to the house.
Well, that might have a bit more in common with today's poet, actually.
Well, quite. So I'm still trying to piece together exactly what happened there. But yeah, so while you were doing your life-affirming, life-lengthening run.
Nature was committing suicide on your doorstep.
scooping up corpses.
Sweet.
That is extremely on brand for today's poet.
Isn't it though, yeah.
Bravo. It could have come straight from his own...
Quoth the catalogue. Magpies nevermore.
Marvellous.
That's mental, yeah. What about you, Dan?
Well, I've got two ways to go on this. We did have a walk in the Ashdown Forest yesterday at a clump of trees that was planted 40 years ago in life imitating art to reflect the E.H. Shepherd illustrations in the A.A. Milne Winnie the Pooh books. They actually planted this particular clump of Scots pines, I think, almost a bit like, Disney World kind of Ashdown Forest.
I've been there quite recently.
Yeah, but that's maybe I'll leave it at that. But I'm a little bit tired today because we
Galleon's had a, Lap, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the area of the Ashdown Forest. So that was very not very Poe though, not very Poe.
It's more Poe than Poe.
More Poe than Poe.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh my God, what a strap line. Yeah, that's very good. So anyway, listeners, if you're not completely tired, I'm sorry we've introduced that slightly off topic.
Yeah, we won't be doing that.
I just
thought
we'd share some of our pre-pod chat.
Glimpse behind the curtain, yeah. So to speak.
The next section in our podcast is where we pick up on the last podcast, because obviously, you know, it is embarrassing going and doing it. We're doing it because we sort of believe in the idea, you know, that we want to just be able to pick up a poem and have a look at it without sort of trying to become self-schooled experts. But that has and can lead to quite major omissions, if not errors. And so the first section of the podcast generally is having a quick opportunity for us to make corrections. But, you know, obviously for ourselves, for our listeners, and in this case also for correspondence. So our last podcast was on a poem by Byron, Lord Byron, written in 1816, called The Darkness.
And possibly without the definite article. I think it's just Darkness. But carry on.
Or just Darkness. Okay, thanks for that. A correction within the correction zone. Exactly. It's kind of like pointing a video camera at the TV filming itself or whatever. Yeah, we had a brilliant a letter from a listener, email from a listener, in which Martin, in which he pointed out, and I have to say, when I read his email, my heart slightly sunk because I thought, oh come on, we should have maybe mentioned this, we should have noticed this. He pointed out that this apocalyptic poem by Byron, written in 1816, and we were sort of going on about the fact that they were up in Lake Geneva and. There was the year without a summer, but perhaps even more germane, as Martin said, to briefly quote him, he said that it was the time, blah, 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 and it would have been influenced by the ravages of war that more or less destroyed Europe during the Napoleonic era. That conflict had just ended before Byron fled England. And the landscape he saw all around him at the time, including on his journey to Geneva, was bleak as anything you might imagine, defined by poverty, devastation, burnt towns, unburied corpses.
Dead magpies.
Dead magpies. Dead pigeons. And so on. This horror, not least in the context of Byron's idolisation of Napoleon and Jacobin ideals in his youth, are also reflected in the poem. So I'm personally grateful to Martin for pointing that out, because of course Europe in 1916, we didn't even mention or think to mention that it was a continent utterly ravaged by war and all of the things that Martin mentions. So I'm very grateful for that correction, for that insight.
I've got a little correction as well, also based on Martin's extraordinary detailed email, which we shouldn't go into in great depth. Martin obviously knows a great deal more about this than we do, and goes point by point on a number of really interesting topics and sort of subtopics along the way. However, just one thing that I sort of pulled out of the air during that last podcast, when we were talking about his Byron's fascination with Armenian culture and history and language, was that I said that famous portrait of Byron, Lord Byron, in the National Portrait Gallery was him in Armenian costume. I must say that was something I sort of improvised in the moment, being fairly confident that it would be brought out by the facts. Martin, however, knocks that one back, saying, in fact, the famous painting of the portrait of Byron is in fact him in Albanian costume, which I'm kicking myself about, since I did know that and I managed to just pull the wrong fact out of the air. So thanks for that correction, Martin.
graciously taken on board there, Rob, with the selfless humility.
Well, you know, there we go. I mean, it's as you say, it's a complete wrong end for the listener, isn't it? And as Dan says, it's good that we can kind of get into this without knowing too much about the poems. But sometimes when we're giving out our opinion, that's quite all right to be mistaken. But when we're giving out facts, it seems that we should probably correct them where possible.
David, I'm sure this doesn't apply to you. Did you have any errata that you wanted to pick up on?
I don't think anything else came up that was specific to anything I said by me, unless I'm wrong even in that. But yeah, certainly it was a slip up to not cover the Napoleonic War context, which I'll be honest is something I'm pretty ignorant about. But obviously I was at least aware that, yeah, there was carnage occurring at the time that it was written. So yeah, that does make perfect sense. So yeah, thanks yeah, Martin, yeah, obviously for that.
Yeah, and just to, I mean, I don't want to restate that, but just to echo that, as I think about it and hear you speaking there, David, it really does make me think how, when I think about the early 19th century, I know about the Napoleonic Wars, but I somehow, I suppose in Britain, you know, there is an accusation, and in this case, a completely correct accusation, that we tend to think of ourselves in quite an insular way, and our first point of reference in our imaginations is often not the European one, and I feel that I've been guilty of that, and I feel that Martin's helped to correct that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we have an exciting what I was calling the exciting news section in the podcast. It is now, I think, established over two or three pods. It is, gentlemen, and I hope you guys have got a question, because it is the quiz section. Now, I'll just say very quickly, I was mentioning to you guys before we started, this is one of those pods where I just time got ahead of me and I didn't really have a chance to really massively look into pose. So I'm not confident I'm going to know the answers to either of your questions, but... I look forward to hearing.
Okay, let me go for mine first. Poe was born in 1809. His parents were acting in a play that year that inspired them to give him his first Christian name. What play were his parents acting in? It's gettable.
Yeah, I'm on this. I know this one.
Okay.
Dan, do you know as well?
I think I do know the answer to this one, amazingly. This would be like walking into a test where you only know the answer to one question and that's the question you've been asked.
It's the one thing we've revised, clearly. That's good. It must be King Lear.
It is indeed King Lear, correct. Well done.
On that note, Rob, are you aware how much longer Poe's parents remained in this world to enjoy their son named after a Shakespearean character?
Is that your question?
No, but that's just a little follow-up question.
No, I don't know.
I know it's not very long, is it?
I know that Poe himself only lurked about for 40 years. Times was tight back then. No, how soon did his parents disappear?
I believe they both died before he was three.
Oh, great.
Or when he was three.
Wow. Yeah. Mm. No, I didn't know that.
David, do you have a quiz question?
I do. My question is, what do the following authors have in common? Edgar Allan Poe, Emily Bronte, Sylvia Plath, and Oscar Wilde. I need something quite specific. Obviously, they are all clearly dead authors.
They were all regional arm wrestling champions.
Not quite as specific as that. Okay, somewhere in between those two things.
Oh gosh, that's a great sounding question for quiz fans. Did you say Emily Bronte, mm-hmm, Oscar Wilde,
and Plath?
And Plath. Yeah.
Did they all write about Tamerlane?
No,
I don't know.
That's a great answer.
It's something to do with their. I'll give you a clue. It's to do with their output, their literary output. They've got one specific. Slightly, I mean, fairly unusual, I suppose.
Did they all die at the age of 40?
No, that's a good shout. But no, Bronte was younger than that, wasn't she? I think she was 30. Not sure how old Wilde was. Hmm. Plath was 30 as well, I think, actually.
Did they all publish in three different text types? Poetry, short stories and novels?
Right, you're absolutely on the right lines now.
Ooh.
They did, or rather, that's not quite true. They definitely all wrote poems, but it's something to do with the other genre in which they also wrote.
They also all wrote short stories?
No.
Did Did they use pseudonyms? I don't think so. They wrote...
No.
They only wrote... No, hang on. Oh, hang on. Ooh, they only wrote one novel.
He's got it.
Yeah, because it's Portrait of Dorian Gray, Wuthering Heights.
Wuthering Heights.
The Bell Jar, and who was the other person?
Poe.
Oh, Poe.
The narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, which I...
Oh, well, I wasn't going
to
get
that. It's a novel I've not got around to.
I've not read that one. I've read everything, but I haven't read that. I must have read the short stories.
So yeah, just the one novel each.
That is a superb question.
Great question.
Yeah, sorry we couldn't get there. Although you did get there, didn't you, Rob?
Yeah, so eventually. Well, yeah, I was led like a horse to water. I could only drink at that point.
Okay. Edgar Allan Poe. I'll say that... I've really got no history of affinity with Edgar Allan Poe. And I know, Rob, that you do a little bit more for reasons which I imagine you'll give in a moment. I don't even think I've seen most of the, like the, is it Roger Corman films?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's more your bailiwick, as I think other things are. So for me, I don't have... I mean, we're going to do this podcast now. In my entire life, I don't think I've had any contact, really. I've known about Edgar Allan Poe, obviously, and I've known about The Raven, and I have read The Raven probably a couple of times, once at university and once since, but that was more for rhythm and sort of technical know-how and metrics. It wasn't as a fascination or an engagement with Poe. So I'm probably, of the three of us, unless you've got other things to say, I've got very little hinterland here.
Have you got a quiz question, though?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Okay. I thought that's where we were leading. But
I forgot my quiz. I was moving on to the next section of the pod. Okay, I'll give you a quiz question here. The great American writer and poet, Edgar Allan Poe, I think he is celebrated in America probably more so than he is over in the UK. He has a connection with an area of London, which British listeners may have heard of in London, called Stoke Newington. Do either of you know the connection between Poe and Stoke Newington?
Interesting.
I do not know. I don't think.
No. I mean, did he
visit? It's biographical. There? Yes, he did visit there.
And did he do something there that was... of interest, then, presumably. It wasn't just that he happened to pop in.
Well, an interesting fact, I don't think you obviously don't know it, but you're right, he did visit there. He went to school in Stoke Newington.
Really?
I think for 4 or 5 years. Yeah.
Blimey.
So he's obviously an American writer, but again, this is quite early, isn't it? It's the first half of the 19th century. So I guess maybe the cultural overlap was greater then, or maybe it's still there. But anyway, yeah, his schooling was in Stoke Newington, believe it or not.
Fancy that.
Okay, good one.
Guys, I'm sorry, I rushed ahead there. And maybe if we could start with you, David, if you just reflect for a moment, Edgar Allan Poe in your sort of backstory.
Yeah, okay. I do know Poe's short stories really quite well. I don't know if I've read absolutely all of them, but there's certainly, I think I'm pretty sure I've read most of them. And I'm, I suppose, like I guess most people who know Poe's stories, I'm more familiar with the kind of gothic ones. What I find really interesting about him, and what is perhaps not well enough known about his short story output, is that he basically invented the detective fiction genre.
With the gold bug.
Yeah, there's three of them, aren't there? There's the Purloined Letter.
That's right.
Yeah. The Gold Bug, and the most famous one, I guess, is the Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Yeah, yeah.
All of which feature this character, Dupin, this French Parisian detective, who predates Sherlock Holmes by many decades. And amongst his sort of more better known kind of dark, weird, troubled, gothic stuff, he also wrote these detective stories. And he sort of dabbled a bit in very early science fiction as well. So I do know the stories quite well, as we've just mentioned. I don't know the novel, the one novel at all. I did read about it a little bit recently.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, David, but just in sort of terms of your personal experience, when do you think, I mean, it's very hard to remember, isn't it? But when did you think you read them? And it sounds like you've read a lot of them, so you must have a bit of an affinity with them.
Certainly studied him at university. He was featured on the, I did a 19th century American literature module, and Poe featured quite heavily, and I found myself to be quite interested. I think he also probably cropped up, actually. I did a science fiction module as well, so I think it probably doubled up. So that's probably why I feel I know those stories quite well, because I think I would have covered them, a few of them, a couple of times. I have also taught a bit of Poe. I've certainly taught the Fall of the House of Usher quite recently. I quite enjoy teaching The Black Cat, The Telltale Heart, another pretty well-known one, isn't it? So yeah, it goes back quite a long way. My knowledge. I don't know, I haven't really read many of them that recently, admittedly, but that is what I do know. The poems, on the other hand, much less familiar, apart from, as you say, The Raven, which is, yeah, that is one that I am pretty familiar with.
Okay. Well, we're not going to be reading The Raven today. I suppose we could have done, but along our ethos, we've chosen to go for ones which we don't know. Rob, do you want to say a little bit about Poe?
Well, I'm very fleetingly, very similar to David, I suppose. I know the short stories well-ish. I think I read them all when I was about 18, because I made a film. I guess I must have read them all then, because I made a film of The Telltale Heart when I was still at Sixth Form College. And so I think I read Tales of Mystery and Imagination, was that collection?
Mm.
And there was one other collection as well. I seem to remember having those two. Or two collections of short stories which I read, and then I think I read them all again about probably still the best part of 20 years ago. I seem to remember at least one of reading them all twice and sort of going back to them a few years later, but mostly obviously it's through the films. It's, as you say, it's the Corman films, and then there's some sort of early 30s stuff. I was always really into horror movies, so that's why that was the link from you know, movies to Poe, really, was through watching the films and knowing vaguely that, like, you know, Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff were in a film called The Black Cat, but it wasn't based on the Poe story, The Black Cat. It was completely different. So sort of getting it, and they also did a film called The Raven together in 1936. So knowing that those things were sort of vaguely Poe influenced, that's probably what led me to the short stories, to see what the true stories were behind them. And there's a couple that are so iconic, like you say, like Casco Amontillado and The Telltale Heart, obviously, yeah, that are just so sort of memorable, brilliant ideas and brilliant images that, yeah, it just feels like it's one of those things that's always been sort of swirling vaguely in the background of my reading life.
You may have forgotten, Rob, but dare I mention your student film?
That's what I was saying, the Telltale Heart film. I did mention that, yeah.
Does that still exist somewhere?
Yeah, somewhere, yeah. It was all right, actually. It was quite a good version. I was 18. It was a success at the time. I don't think it'd stand up to great scrutiny now, but it did all right at the time. And I've always appreciated Poe more than I would have appreciated any other 19th century American novelists or short story writers. Well, that's for sure.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because if you'd asked me about Poe, I would have thought short story writer. But we're going to be looking at Poe's poetry today, which is a different thing, isn't it? And I guess it's going to be interesting for us to delve into these poems today and have a look at Poe, the poet, which I hadn't really thought of him apart from the knowledge of The Raven as a poet. So I guess his reputation is very much, I would think it would be right to say, in most people's minds as a short story writer. I don't know. And The Raven, I don't know how many of his other poems people would be able to name, even as they listen to this podcast.
The only other poem by him that I could have definitely named before, you know, starting to properly look into him this week was Annabel Lee. Which isn't one I don't think that we're going to be looking at today. But that's the reason I came to that poem a long time ago now, was through the novel Lolita by Nabokov, which I think Nabokov was quite a big fan of Poe. And he, literally, I think the first page of that novel, he alludes very heavily to Annabel Lee, the Poe poem, which I believe was the last thing he wrote before his fairly early death.
Well, that might be an appropriate moment to, before we move on to our first poem, to just cover a little bit of biographical ground. You said, Rob, that he was born in 1809.
Died in 1849.
Oh, so he's like 40 when he dies.
Yeah. Significantly younger than all of us.
Yes. His parents die when he's very young. He's not adopted, but somehow taken in by John Allen. He adds the Allen to his name. Although YouTube told me a few nights ago, when I sort of watched half of a thing on YouTube, that he didn't sign himself Edgar Allan Poe. Apparently, he signed himself Edgar Poe. But the Allen thing was, I don't know, it was a conflicted thing in his life.
He didn't like him, did he? I don't think they got on at all.
No.
That's probably the reason for that.
He'd been adopted, not adopted, as you say, by this guy at John Allen, who paid for his education in London, some years of schooling at any rate. And then they come back to the States, and what happens then? Do we know anything?
Essentially, he lives a pretty troubled existence, doesn't he? I mean, we were talking last time about the Byronic hero, and he kind of lives out that lifestyle quite a bit from what I've read. He is quite rootless and unhappy, and goes from is he married more than once, or just does he have a succession of kind of failed relationships? He ends up quite famously marrying his very young cousin, doesn't he?
Yeah, his wife died.
She dies.
That is his very young cousin.
Yeah.
He marries her when she's 13, and she dies, I think, when she's 19. I don't know if that's the exact right date age that she was when she died, but she's pretty young anyway when she dies.
And there are dead young women littered throughout his work, as there are all kinds of psychoses and references to alcoholism, which he certainly suffered from.
Yeah.
It doesn't come as any great surprise, I suppose, with that, you know, when you think about Poe's work, that it's dark, that it's got some a lot of horror in it, that he did have this very, very disturbed life. He was very young when his parents died. He had this antagonistic relationship with John Allen. He marries his young cousin, who then dies of, is it TB?
Yeah, I think.
And he's a bit older by then. I think he's like 29 when he marries. So he's only got another 11 years left, which he spends being a sort of alcoholic magazine editor and short story writer.
Yeah. Oh, get this. This is a particularly sweet detail. One evening in January 1842, Virginia, the young wife, showed the first signs of consumption, now known as tuberculosis, while singing and playing the piano, which Poe described as breaking a blood vessel in her throat. So she died of singing. Ugh.
It was intense. I mean, his personal existential experience was pretty, pretty dark. Guys, we're going to move on to our first poem. But before we do, I was saying to you guys earlier on, I just read a tiny bit earlier on before one or two things came, it stopped me from doing so. But he wrote an essay called The Imp of the Perverse. Mm-hmm. I mean, an amazing title, The Imp of the Perverse. And just to put it into perspective, this is 1, 2, 3, 4 pages long. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, don't worry. But basically, I guess this is dated 1845. So whatever, he's a few years before he dies. And the gist of this essay is it's sort of proto-psychology and sort of proto the subconscious, because he's talking about, he describes the people who he is up against, not up against, but he's arguing against, as either phrenologists or metaphysicians. I'm guessing that maybe the term psychologist wasn't in play at that time, and that's why he uses these other words. But he basically says that they haven't recognised this key aspect or driver of human life, which he calls in the title of the essay the imp of the perverse. And I came to this passage, one paragraph, but it's quite a long paragraph, but I do hope that you'll think it was worth reading. So you've already picked up, I'm sure, that he's talking in some way about some kind of unrecognized, either phrenological or metaphysical drive. So we might say the subconscious or something. And he's talking about how this imp of the perverse doesn't seem to do the right thing. It seems to lead to people to do actions which are contrary to any positive rational outcome. And there's one paragraph which particularly stood out for me. It's this. He says, "We have a task before us which must be speedily performed. We know that it will be ruinous to make delay. The most important crisis of our life calls, trumpet-tongued, for immediate energy and action. We glow, we are consumed with eagerness to commence the work, with the anticipation of whose glorious result our whole souls are on fire. It must, it shall be undertaken today. And yet we put it off until tomorrow. And why? There is no answer, except that we feel perverse, using the word with no comprehension of the principle. Tomorrow arrives, and with it a more impatient anxiety to do our duty. But with this very increase of anxiety arrives also a nameless, a positively fearful, because unfathomable, craving for delay. This craving gathers strength as the moments fly. The last hour for action is at hand. We tremble with the violence of the conflict within us, of the definite with the indefinite, of the substance with the shadow. But if the contest have proceeded thus far, it is the shadow which prevails. We struggle in vain. The clock strikes, and it is the knell of our welfare. At the same time, it is the chanticleer note to the ghost that has so long overawed us. It flies, it disappears, we are free." But I thought that on a sort of procrastination was pretty...
Yeah, I'm going to quote that to Kerry when she asks me to paint the bedroom next week.
Right, shall we ring the gong and go on to our first poem?
This poem, it, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is called Romance. David, you're going to read that poem, I believe. And Rob, do you have it in front of you? Will you give the second?
Yes, I can have another crack at it, yeah.
Okay. We'll see you after this for the poem Romance.
Sure.
Romance by Edgar Allan Poe. Romance, who loves to nod and sing, with drowsy head and folded wing, among the green leaves as they shake far down within some shadowy lake. To me a painted paroquet hath been a most familiar bird, taught me my alphabet to say, to lisp my very earliest word, while in the wild wood I did lie, a child, with a most knowing eye. Of late, eternal condor years so shake the very heaven on high, with tumult as they thunder by. I have no time for idle cares, through gazing on the unquiet sky. And when an hour with calmer wings its down upon my spirit flings, that little time with lyre and rhyme to while away forbidden things, my heart would feel to be a crime unless it trembled with the strings.
Okay. This is Romance by Edgar Allan Poe. Romance, who loves to nod and sing with drowsy head and folded wing among the green leaves as they shake far down within some shadowy lake. To me, a painted parakeet hath been a most familiar bird, taught me my alphabet to say, to lisp my very earliest word, while in the wild wood I did lie, a child with a most knowing eye. Of late, eternal condor years so shake the very heaven on high with tumult as they thunder by. I have no time for idle cares, through gazing on the unquiet sky. And when an hour with calmer wings its down upon my spirit flings, that little time with lyre and rhyme to while away, forbidden things, my heart would feel to be a crime unless it trembled with the strings. Huh. It's a mysterious little poem, isn't it?
It is. I hesitate to say this before we go on to talk about romance, but I'm holding in my hands a book called The Complete Poetry and Selected Criticism of Edgar Allan Poe by Alan Tate. And as my eyes glance down from the poet romance, they glance down to the notes at the bottom of the page, which is actually, I then sadly realise, is to do with the stanza above. But the first note is C.F. Byron's Darkness.
Oh,
fantastic. Yeah, so there's a bit of continuity there. Romance, who loves to nod and sing. Personification of romance, kind of a classical thing going on there.
Let me just jump in, Dan, and say that I think I just read that he published this poem when he was 20.
Okay, that's a good fact.
He's a juvenile.
So this is, I think, before he's... juvenilia. Yeah. Romance, who loves to nod and sing, with drowsy head and folded wing. I don't know if I've ever seen romance personified with folded wings. Is that something which one might be aware of?
No, there's a whole bird thing going through this, isn't there? There's a sort of bird motif which kind of evolves from or changes at least from something. Well, a parakeet, isn't it? Parakeet, obviously, is how he wants it pronounced because it rhymes with the line after the next
say.
One.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, parakeet, alphabet to say. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, and then you've got the condor, which is the largest flying bird, isn't it? The condor, the kind of huge, great wingspan that soars around.
Not as big as the albatross, but nevertheless big.
Is that right?
I think okay. So. Yeah.
It's pretty big, though. Yeah.
Yeah, it's enormous. Yeah, and in America, it was probably the biggest in America.
But yeah, to be honest, at this early stage of having just read the thing, I'm struggling to know where I'm going with this idea of romance as a bird. Help me out, someone.
Well, he's saying. To me, romance has been a painted parakeet. It's been a very familiar bird that taught me from my earliest childhood. Romance has always been part of my life. It's always been in me. But recently, the eternal condor years, so shake the very heaven on high with tumult as they thunder by. I have no time for idle cares. Through gazing on the unquiet sky. So he's losing the romance in his life. The attrition of time has worn him down so that romance no longer exists for him. He hasn't got the time to be a romantic.
It fits quite, I think, quite nicely with what Dan just read out, doesn't it?
The
Imp of the Perverse. And I mean, Poe, from what you can sort of tell from his writing, from his short stories, he was a deeply sort of agitated man, wasn't he? He was clearly totally restless, and as a young man here, so yeah, 20 years old, so this is 1829-ish, so he's writing still in what we'd now call the Romantic era. I did read somewhere that Byron was his hero, and of course Byron's still writing and is still alive at this point when he's writing this as well. You definitely sense that this is a young man who feels a bit kind of tied down and is desperate to get up and get out there and live a life, yeah.
But, I mean, bear in mind he's only 20, well, he published when he was 20, so let's say he's a teenager, he's a late teens, let's assume.
Yeah.
So he's already starting to look back on his life as a life which is passing, and something already has changed in him and already been lost. You know, he's already contrasting himself with a child version of himself who could be more romantic and...
He's quite sort of damning of his past, isn't he? The taught me my alphabet to say, to lisp my very earliest word. And sort of drowsy head and folded wing. It's a bit sort of regretful and slight and somewhat self-deprecating, would you say, about his existence up to this point?
I'm not sure. Maybe, because it's three parts to this poem, isn't there? Because then he updates it and says, but of late, you know, I don't have time. I have no time for idle cares. But then he says, and when an owl with calmer wings is available, it's down upon my spirit flings. That little time with lyre and rhyme to while away, forbidden things.
Well, that's the mystery in this poem, isn't it?
Unless it trembled with the strings. So he's saying he still finds time, he still makes time, because it's a crime not to be romantic. It's a crime not to be, you know, lyrical and to take the opportunity to, you know, loaf and examine a spear of summer grass or whatever. You know, he has to find this, make this time, even now in his busy life, you know, in the hectic life he's living.
Isn't it a bit more sort of adolescent than that, in the sense that when one looks back on one's adolescence, which, you know, life in a way is a permanent struggle to move out of, one can think, well, I can anyway, of sort of rather embarrassing things that one had said in order to position or posture oneself as having become older than one really was. To put that into perspective, when we were in, you know, let's say high school for the international audience, you know, 17, 18, whatever, you know, going out into town and going to nightclubs and stuff. And I distinctly remember conversations I had with people when I was about 20, i.e. about a year later, where people were sort of coming back and going, oh, yeah, I'm much too grown up now to go to nightclubs, you know. And it was a sort of a posture. And isn't there an element of that sentiment in this poem that he's basically saying, if he is, as you've said, David, 20 when he's writing this, he's writing about this innocent time where he used to enjoy these infatuations from an early age, which is no doubt true, that romance hath been a most familiar bird, taught me my alphabet to say, to lisp my very earliest word, while in the wild wood I did lie. I mean, that's a very romantic capital R kind of image, isn't it? And even an earlier image of the sort of the idyllic freedom of childhood. And actually the last line of that stanza is, a child with a most knowing eye. So that was his early, but now, oh no, mate, I'm 20, I've got a leather jacket.
Although, hang on, I think the most knowing eye doesn't belong to the child, it belongs to the romance. A most familiar bird taught me my alphabet to say, with a most knowing eye. Right?
Oh, maybe that's it. So maybe that's the beginning of the darkening of knowledge, that the, you know, that this bird, which is symbolising romance, knew that there was that the sort of the purity of the earlier ideal that he had wouldn't last. I don't know.
Possibly so. Yeah.
But of late, eternal condor years, so shake the very heaven on high. So I mean, I'm not belittling his travails, because obviously he was upset and disturbed, but isn't he kind of saying, I can no longer enjoy the sort of purity of these infatuations I once had. I have no time for idle cares through gazing on the unquiet sky. Could that be that there's more important things now that he's, you know, aware to be aware of?
Yeah,
and he's even when the opportunity arises to kind of gaze, just to have a kind of calm hour, he feels as though he needs to be using that time somehow. He's kind of, that last line I find really interesting, that you shouldn't be enjoying kind of solitude or whatever comes with that, that you should be sort of finding the kind of pain in there somehow. You should be sort of mining it for some kind of artistic, because that seems to fit with what I imagine a 20-year-old in 1829 would think of his romantic poet heroes that they were doing. Not wasting any time at all. Not even wasting their downtime. Not even wasting their leisure time. But turning that into poetry.
But let's just drill down on that final line. My heart would feel to be a crime unless it trembled with the strings. What does that mean? What does trembled mean?
I'm just really literally coming to this thought now. So it's a live thought happening. But I would say that this poem is about his commitment to becoming a great poet.
Yeah.
And I think that the lyre is an image, isn't it, of God knows, you know, one of these Greek things where he's an image of the muse and poetry. And I think that when he says forbidden things, maybe he's saying that's a waste of time. I'm not going to do that now. My heart would feel it to be a crime, i.e. a waste of time, unless it trembled with the strings.
Yeah.
In other words, unless he was being moved by the cosmic muse that he's now set up as being his main squeeze.
Yeah, that's I'd go along with that.
Definitely. Yeah, sounds right. That little time.
So where this is important is he's setting out his stall. And I think David has just said that he admired Byron greatly. And I guess this was the way to go. If you wanted to be a poet in those days, or maybe today, who knows? You know, it wasn't just dilettante or intellectual. It was like, I'm setting out now to be a great poet.
Yeah.
Do we think that, yeah, having established that, do we think this is a great poem?
No. No.
Why do you say that, Rob?
I don't know, it feels slight and the images feel a bit woozy and vague. I'm not feeling like it's incisively speaking to me at all.
No, sure. I mean, I suppose in a way you'd kind of... It's what you'd expect a bit, isn't it? We've looked at a few examples of early, sort of juvenilia, as you say.
Yeah, I think this is poets. It feels like it's been written by somebody who's 19. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's in a way I quite like that though. There's something quite sort of charming about that. I don't mean that patronisingly, but you want a poem by a young person to sound like a poem by a young person. You don't want it to sound kind of old before its time. Yeah, we talked in a bit about that Rossetti one. And how that she wrote when she was really young, and how she sort of felt that she was kind of already, she'd already lived a life, and that there was not much point almost going on. And at least with this, you feel, I quite like the idea that he's sort of setting his stall out a bit. It's kind of almost a kind of manifesto of how he's going to live and write.
As I think about it, I think that we very patronisingly and erroneously call poems, when a poet is young, juvenilia, which is a poncy word anyway, in my opinion. Excuse me, gentlemen, I'm getting a little bit. actually, if you've got a decent writer, or perhaps a great writer in Poe's case, who's prepared to set down their perception of when they're 19 or 20, that's as important in a way, isn't it, as them setting it down when they're 40 or when they're 60, when their different concerns have come to bear.
Yeah.
But here you've got an imprint of a powerful imprint of how he felt at that time. I'm sure I'm not the first person to think this, but to decry them in a way because they reflect the concerns of adolescence seems a bit sort of wrong and a bit snooty and a bit sort of placing, if this was a poem by a 45-year-old who'd fought in wars and had a different perception on life, we might all be thinking, oh, well, this is very wise. But the fact that it's not necessarily wisdom, and it is a little bit overly passionate and perhaps even self-dramatising.
No, I don't think it's very good. I don't feel like the images really hold together. It's not because he's young, it's just because he's not very good yet. He's warming up. Let's do Arthur Rimbaud at some point. I mean, he comes straight out of the box, full force, brilliant right from the get-go, you know what I mean?
I read that Poe was a big influence on Arthur Rimbaud.
Interesting. Yeah, it would make sense.
When I say I read that there was an Eliot lecture devoted to that subject. I don't know any more than that fact.
I take your point. And what David says is true. You want a young person's poem to feel like a young person's poem, not just be some copy of some older person's poem. You want it to feel like it's a committed, you know, idea from the writer. But, yeah, I don't know, this feels a bit light on its feet, this. Doesn't feel like it's really got much of a thought, really. And I just don't feel like the rhyme scheme doesn't end very, it doesn't seem to land, it doesn't trip off the tongue, it doesn't seem to read particularly well. That might be our fault, obviously.
It's true that,
it's clumsy a bit, the rhyme scheme, I think.
Yeah, well, one of Poe's massive strengths as a poet, certainly, you know, I speak, you know, almost entirely, exclusively from my knowledge of The Raven. But that poem, as Dan kind of mentioned earlier on, is really notable for its technical mastery. It's just extraordinary the way he sustains over, because it's pretty long, he sustains a really complicated rhyme scheme, with internal rhymes and all kinds of technical wizardry going on there. Obviously at this point, much earlier in his career, he hasn't got there yet. Because, yeah, it's a much less sort of rhythmical, comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, this right
read,
here,
even with the rhiming.
This is in iambic tetrameter, isn't it? But the fourth line already goes wonky. Romance who loves to nod and sing with drowsy head and folded wing among the green leaves as they shake far down within some shadowy lake. Whoops.
Mm-hmm.
Bang.
Rob, could I just rewind you? Yeah. I don't know whether this is an appropriate type of a question for our pod, but you've just used that word iambic tetrameter. No. What does that mean?
Well, it means there's four iams in each line, which is an iam is two syllables, one stressed and one unstressed syllable. I am. Romance, who loves to nod and sing.
And tetra is four, is it?
Yeah, that's right. And this is in that meter, and it's got an odd rhyme scheme, which is, so it goes sing, wing, shake, lake, parroquet, bird, say, word, lie, eye, years, high, thunder, by, cares, sky, wings, flings, rhyme, things, crime, strings. So it's very, very elegantly done, and elegantly done from in terms of the end rhymes. But I don't know, it just didn't seem to, I don't know, I mean, compared to other poems, I suppose, it just doesn't seem to be, feel particularly rhythmically satisfying. Maybe we just mangled it in the reading, it's possible.
Do you know what? My thoughts are gathering, and I'm, again, hesitant to say it. When we were looking at Byron, is this, I think, a Byronic stanza structure? Maybe
it
not.
Could be.
Might be.
No, it was no, because it was eight. He had eight lines. Ottavo Rima was eight lines, yeah. And these are one, two, three, four, five, six,
that's
seven,
correct,
eight. Yeah. Nine. Yeah, this is an 11-line stanza. So I don't know what this is.
I mean, I think it's a sort of an experimental. Kind of tryout, isn't it? Really,
yeah.
it's an early exercise, and it's, you know, and it's got plenty going for it for in those terms, and obviously it's got its weaknesses. If we're going to try and judge it by any higher standards than that, I would say. But I think it's a good starting point. It's probably a good, you know, it's a good way in, isn't it? To his.
Well, I like the way I like forever. I like the idea that he's setting out his stall, age 20, and saying, as you say, I am a poet, and not to commit to this, not to commit to my heart trembling with the strings is a crime, you know, and I'm going to embrace these forbidden things and pick up my lyre and rhyme. Yeah,
yeah. Do we think is the word romance, is that how we think of it now? Has that changed, do we think? 1829. Obviously the romantic poets, I mean, they didn't know themselves as the romantic poets, did they?
Calling Martin.
Yeah. I mean, that's a term that's been applied to them subsequently.
I don't think this will be romantic love insofar as he's talking about it being, you know, taught my alphabet to say. So, I mean, we're talking about him being a child, you know, in the wild wood. So I don't think that's romantic love, is it? I think romance is more to be a dreamer, to be a romantic at heart, so to speak, rather than have, you know, romantic love, yeah.
Sure.
What it meant semantically at this time, I don't know exactly, and it is an interesting question. You said, David, that you don't think the romantic poets, capital R, as mandated by Michael Gove in the National Curriculum, knew themselves to be romantic poets. Is that correct,
I'm
do we think?
Pretty sure that's true. I don't know when the term was coined, but I don't think it was at the time.
Right, so it would have been some criticism in the later or after their time who looked back on that era and said they were the capital R romantics.
Would be my guess, yeah.
When there was some kind of reaction against them. Because, I mean, romance meant, as Rob just sort of said, but it comes from the sort of the European, the romances, weren't they? Were sort of the knights, the chivalry, the idealised, slightly fantastical genres.
Sure. So that's what he's dreaming of.
But that actually adds a dimension to it, because if it's not specifically romantic love that he's saying he hasn't got so much time for, i.e. infatuations, but he doesn't have time for romance, it almost suggests that he's looking for something more serious to write about, something more serious to meditate on as his appropriate top sort of subject for poetry.
Yeah, and he hasn't hit upon it yet.
No, but he has been gazing on the unquiet sky.
Yeah, and
and the years have shaken very heaven with tumult.
And yeah, I mean, let's face it, things got tumultuous for him. he anticipated successfully. Maybe he deliberately sort of made the prophecy come true. It was that kind of. He lived a life that was sort of darkly self-fulfilling almost.
Shall we have a look at the next poem?
Yeah. Mm.
Okay, so the next poem is going to be called City in the Sea. Well, I've chosen this one, so I should read it first. Who's going to do the second reading?
Dave, do you want to take it on?
Yeah, sure.
I think this is slightly longer. I hope not too long for our listeners. 71 in this book. Okay, it's about a page and a half. We will see you after the gong, when we will hear Edgar Allan Poe's The City in the Sea. The City in the Sea. Lo, death has reared himself a throne in a strange city, lying alone far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. There shrines and palaces and towers, time-eaten towers that tremble not, resemble nothing that is ours, around by lifting winds forgot. Resignedly beneath the sky, the melancholy waters lie. No rays from the holy heaven come down on the long night-time of that town, but light from out the lurid sea streams up the turret silently, gleams up the pinnacles far and free, up domes, up spires, up kingly halls, up fanes, up Babylon-like walls, up shadowy long-forgotten bowers of sculptured ivy and stone flowers, up many and many a marvellous shrine whose wreathed friezes intertwine the vial, the violet, and the vine. Resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie. So blend the turrets and shadows there that all seem pendulous in air, while from a proud tower in the town death looks gigantically down. there open fanes and gaping graves yawn level with the luminous waves, but not the riches there that lie in each idol's diamond eye, not the gaily jewelled dead tempt the waters from their bed, for no ripples curl, alas, along that wilderness of glass. No swellings tell that winds may be upon some far-off happier sea. No heavings hint that winds have been on seas less hideously serene. But lo, a stir is in the air. The wave, there is a movement there, as if the towers had thrust aside in slightly sinking the dull tide, as if their tops had feebly given a void within the filmy heaven. The waves have now a redder glow, the hours are breathing faint and low, and when amid no earthly moans, down, down that town shall settle hence, hell, rising from a thousand thrones, shall do it reverence.
Okay, for the second time, The City in the Sea by Edgar Allan Poe. Lo, death has reared himself a throne in a strange city lying alone, far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. There, shrines and palaces and towers, time-eaten towers that tremble not, resemble nothing that is ours. Around, by lifting winds forgot, resignedly beneath the sky, the melancholy waters lie. No rays from the holy heaven come down on the long night time of that town, but light from out the lurid sea streams up the turrets silently, gleams up the pinnacles far and free, up domes, up spires, up kingly halls, up fanes, up Babylon-like walls, up shadowy long-forgotten bowers of sculptured ivy and stone flowers, up many and many a marvellous shrine whose wreathed friezes intertwine the vial, the violet, and the vine. Resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie, so blend the turrets and shadows there that all seem pendulous in air, while from a proud tower in the town death looks gigantically down. There open fanes and gaping graves yawn level with the luminous waves, but not the riches there that lie in each idol's diamond eye, not the gaily jewelled dead tempt the waters from their bed, for no ripples curl, alas, along that wilderness of glass. No swellings tell that winds may be upon some far-off happier sea, no heavings hint that winds have been on seas less hideously serene. But lo, a stir is in the air, the wave, there is a movement there, as if the towers had thrust aside in slightly sinking the dull tide, as if their tops had feebly given a void within the filmy heaven. The waves have now a redder glow, the hours are breathing faint and low, and when, amid no earthly moans, down, down that town shall settle hence, hell, rising from a thousand thrones, shall do it reverence.
Huh. It's grim, isn't it?
Do you want to know the first note that I glanced down to in my Alan Tate's edited and with an introduction by edition?
Does it say that this is a reminiscent of Byron's Darkness, by any chance?
It says C.F. Byron's Darkness.
Yeah, man.
Oh, come on, Alan Tate. give us something else. He's not even trying.
Which is an enormous coincidence, because we absolutely had nothing in our mind to make us think about this. Well,
no.
Obviously we did. But, okay, somebody say something about this.
Well, I mean, just on that note of Byron's Darkness, there is one particularly strikingly similar passage, which is that, I think, fourth stanza, you know, where the waters themselves are dead and the ocean is just completely flat. And there was that passage, you know, the Dead Sea with the boats just listing and sinking into it slowly was the sort of last part of Darkness, wasn't it? So this is very similar to that, I think, you know, this whole thing about the penultimate paragraph. No swellings tell that winds may be upon some far-off happier sea, no heavings hint that winds have been on seas less hideously serene. That's a very similar image.
Good spot, because those were the precise lines that comment on Alan Tate's book referred to.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, what is this? This is a kind of big gothic grim fantasia, isn't it, of a city of death that...
This is like, people say, don't they, that Poe was influential in inventing several genres, and we mentioned the detective one earlier on, but people have talked about science fiction. There's a lot of James Cameron's what year's The Abyss?
89, maybe, yeah.
88, 89. I mean, there's quite a sci-fi flourish to this, isn't there? The idea of this city in the water. Not to spoil the ending of The Abyss, but...
Yeah, a strange city lying alone far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. So the city is a city of the dead, isn't it? And they're in this limbo waiting to be elevated, or and time has stopped.
Yeah,
and they're just in a limbo of death. But it's this glorious, vast town. And then towards the end of the poem, suddenly the sort of gears of time begin to move again. And the city finally sinks into the sea.
I think it's worse than that, because I've just looked up the word fanes. Oh, yeah. Alan Tate has told me that fanes means temples. And if you've got anything better on that, I'd be interested to hear, because the beginning of the penultimate stanza, so we're looking at line 30.
Yeah.
There open fanes and gaping graves. So if a fane is more like a mausoleum type thing than a Buddhist temple, I'm thinking in this line we know that graves are now gaping open.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing maybe fanes has got a more sepulchral connotation.
Very
than
possibly,
simply
yeah.
Temple. Yawn level with the luminous waves. So it's like there's almost like floating corpses.
No, the water the water hasn't carried off the dead yet, has it? They're just ready.
No, but they're suspended. They're suspended in this. I mean, you said, you used the word, what did you say? It began with L, I think.
Limbo.
Limbo, yeah.
I think that's what this is, isn't it? They are in limbo. This city is collected its dead, and now it will take them down to hell, basically.
So is it literally about people that have died at sea?
I don't know.
No.
That have never had a proper burial and that are therefore in limbo.
No, because if it was, why would there be this whole city of domes and kingly halls? And
I think this is more of a metaphor, you know, for maybe for modernity, the sense of of people that are living in the city are just, you know, waiting to be dragged to hell, waiting to die. They're just living in this sort of meaningless. And maybe that's the metaphor. Obviously, that's not what the poem is saying. The poem is a kind of a, you know, big twisted gothic fantasy, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting that we were talking about romance just now. And as I say, one of the connotations or the associations or the semantics of that, I think, is this, you know, romance was these knights and chivalry and shining armour and all the rest of it, and castles and, you know, in the sort of, I don't know, the medieval period. And here he's got quite a medieval city going on, hasn't he? Turrets, pinnacles. I mean, he even resorts to the, one might say, clumsy Babylon-like compound adjective.
Yeah.
It's this sort of historic imagining of a city, almost a romantic in the medieval sense imagining of a city.
Yeah, and he says though that that sorry, there is in we should make this clear for the audience. That stanza one, their shrines and palaces and towers. That's T H E R E, as in it's over there, not there, as in belonging to them. Their shrines and palaces and towers resemble nothing that is ours. So it's a completely alien landscape, isn't it?
That's yeah.
And also there's an inclusive ours there. So Poe is talking to the reader there, I suppose, saying yeah. Our world is totally different to this place. It's funny that it's in the West, isn't it? So far down within the dim
that,
West.
That could be a sort of a slightly classical Homeric thing because, you know, the sun sets in the West, doesn't it? And there's often in these nautical stories, there's this thing about the West, like where the sun goes down. When I say nautical, I mean like he's, you know, on the Mediterranean.
Well,
stuff.
Unless he's writing from the East Coast and has had a recent visit to Los Angeles, because, I mean, you know, frankly, this describes that fucking hellhole quite
I
well.
I see. Yeah. This is about LA and it's written from Baltimore.
That's right.
Death has reared himself a throne in a strange city lying alone far down within the dim West. Yeah. Could be, couldn't it? Prescient critique on Hollywood.
Resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie. So it's this completely dead place, melancholy waters.
I've never seen anything like this poem, and I think it's better than The Darkness. Yeah. Oh, sorry, darkness. No definite article, as you've told me.
Well, it doesn't have the human dimension. It's got no characters in this, whereas Darkness had a great deal of sort of human drama contained within it, didn't it? You know, the characters seeing each other and expiring, and people, the dog protecting its dead master, and, you know, the dead eating each other. It had the kind of the huge kind of sickening spectacle of humanity's last desperate, panicky, you know, death throes. Whereas this is just everybody's already in their graves. This city is just...
But it's this weird emphasis on the fact that it is neither above sea or under the sea. And that there's no winds. I mean, it's quite hard, if you had to paint this, it's hard to know where everything is in relation to the surface of the water. Because the surface of the water is a wilderness of glass. No swellings tell that tides may be upon some far-off happier sea. So it's like the sea is completely flat and still.
Yeah.
And it's just on the level of the of the things that are going on in this city.
He is that sort of oxymoron is the end of the penultimate stanza. The hideously serene seems a little bit like what he was saying in that first poem, the dissatisfaction with things being still and calm and normal, and the kind of restless need for something much more tumultuous. So he kind of makes that happen in the final stanza, doesn't he?
And, yes, although that...
Sorry, go on.
No, you go ahead.
Well, it's just, it's kind of... that was the sort of resolution that Poe always wanted. If you look at the ends of his stories, they tend to end with something dramatic and horrific. And I think he's craving that, isn't he? He sort of he wants that to happen. There's a kind of slightly sort of morbid satisfaction in the final lines.
Yeah, well, it's not his city, is it, though? This is just a ghastly spectacle to him.
Yeah, but it's the whole thing clearly is a sort of fantasy, isn't it? A kind of phantasmagorical creation of his own.
Yeah.
Which he can do what he wants with. And it feels to me as though he is taking some kind of delight in kind of creating this setting and then destroying it or doing something with it, which is what he does routinely in his short fiction.
Yeah.
Just one note on hideously serene, though. I mean, it's hideously serene because there's a load of corpses floating around.
I don't think they are floating.
not floating, but...
Where are these floating corpses?
Very slightly submerged. First line of the penultimate stanza. Their open fanes and gaping graves yawn level with the luminous raves. Waves. I mean, what does gaping graves mean?
But not the riches there that lie in each idol's diamond eye, not the gaily jewelled dead tempt the waters from their bed. So they're not in the waters yet.
Yeah, they are in the water. The water is in their bed, i.e. in their open grave.
Maybe.
Well, but not the riches there that lie in each idol's diamond eye, nor the gaily jewelled dead. So whatever the dead are wearing by way of accessories, I think that's the term that one uses. Even their ability to accessorize, even in death, none of these things tempt the waters from their bed. Here, T-H-E-I-R, their bed. In other words, the water is in their grave.
Oh, I thought it was the water's own bed, i.e. the hideously serene, unmoving flatness of this wilderness of glass. The waters are in their beds and they're not shifting. And nothing can lure them.
Where do you get the sense that... So if there is... I mean, there's no other interpretation, is there? If the water is like glass...
Yeah.
Then everything is submerged, somewhat, but not an enormous amount. Is that what you think? I don't know.
No, I think it's like the everything is just poised, just this fraction above the stillness of the water. It's just standing out of the water, this city, just with the water at that level of their graves, that maybe just fractionally below, and then it's just waiting to sink. And that's what happens in the final stanza. You know, the waters finally part. Although he says actually it's that as if the towers had thrust aside in slightly sinking the dull tide. So finally, the city just starts to move down again. And there was a thing about time here, wasn't there? When he says, "Oh, the hours are breathing faint and low." It's like time has started again, just enough to suck this city down to hell.
Shall we have a very brief diversion into underwater cities? I'll start.
Do it, absolutely.
Now, I believe that when Sean Connery returned to the role of 007... in, I'm going to say 1971, although I'm prepared to take correction, the movie was called Diamonds Are Forever.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
And I believe that, I can't remember the name of the baddie in Diamonds Are Forever, but does he not live in a city in the sea?
Who?
Oh, is it? In Diamonds Are Forever, it's a James Bond film.
Yeah.
There's a kind of like a large aluminium-coloured...
Is it Charles Grey?
Well, I was going to say, is it Charles Grey? So if we're both thinking the same thing, it might possibly
probably
be.
Is,
do you remember it's got like four...
Yeah, I think it is Blofeld. Yeah.
Charles Grey said Blofeld, didn't it? I think that's right.
It's got like... It's like an aluminium sort of metal-looking thing with like four huge legs, and it can be either completely submerged and then it comes up, no?
Yeah, I believe you're right. Yeah, good city in the sea, like it.
All right. What have you got, lads?
This reminds me, this poem actually, of a scene from that film, which I didn't think was particularly good, but Inception. There's that sort of post-apocalyptic image of the sea lapping at the heels of the city, and the city slowly crumbling in, one sort of skyscraper at a time. And it's sort of where it's in the far-flung future of what it's in his dream, actually, but it's this sort of dream image of the sea slowly eating a city, and the towers crumbling in like the sides of a huge glacier, but instead of huge chunks of ice, it's entire sort of city blocks sort of tumbling into the sea. It's got that image in my mind very strongly.
But that may be relevant, because I haven't actually seen Inception. I put my hand up to that, but I am aware of it. And isn't that about something about the certainty of consciousness, and something about whether things are or are not.
It's about dreams. It's about going into an out of people's dreams and then dreams within a dreams, which is, I think, actually a title of a Poe poem, in fact, isn't it? A dream within a dream.
Is it?
Yeah. But suffice it to say, that's got this image in it of I think the dream within the dream within the dream. At the lowest bottom layer of the dream, there's everything is ruined, and because it's this, the dream becomes unstable and the dream starts collapsing, and this, and the environment you're in the dream starts to sort of fall apart, and in this kind of really apocalyptic sequence, as I say, the city starts just crumbling into the sea.
But that may be partly what's going on here, because there is a sort of an imagined psychology here, isn't there, that he's trying to get to, this sense that is it real or isn't it real? You know, it seems to hover in this indeterminate land, yeah, almost quite purposefully, as if he's exploring a new, or I don't know, yeah. David, City Under the Sea, what have you got?
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I've been trying to think of an example. I can't think of any. I need to go away and watch films with cities in the sea.
Well, doesn't have to be from a film, but they're coming to me thick and fast.
Go on then, help me out.
What's the one where Robert De Niro plays a shark?
Shark Tale.
Shark Tale?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it, but yeah.
He and Scorsese together as sharks, yeah.
The Little Mermaid. I believe there's a city under the sea in that.
I believe you're right. Aquaman. Yeah,
sounds about.
I haven't seen Aquaman. Is there a city under the sea in that?
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah, Atlantis. In fact,
Well, I suppose Warlords of Atlantis. Atlantis is somehow they come to it through a diving bell, don't they?
I believe so. We may be slightly getting off the point there. Death looks gigantically down is my favourite line in this poem.
Yeah, that's hands down the winner.
Yeah, it's quite frightening. While from a proud tower in the town, death looks gigantically down. So suddenly death isn't abstract anymore. It's totally personified. I mean, it goes back to that first line, "Lo, death has reared himself a throne in a strange city lying alone." But the idea that death has claimed this land, this city, and is looking down gigantically from this proud tower is pretty ghastly.
Maybe we were too quick to, or I was too quick to David's suggestion that this is about people who've died at sea. Maybe it is. Are you holding to that, David? Do you have any evidence?
I haven't seen anything to completely deter me from that view. I mean, I'm slightly, as we all admitted at the start, we don't know the his novel, but it is set at sea. I know that much.
Right.
And I think grim,
there's descent into the maelstrom as well.
Quite, which is, and there's that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's that. One of his stories, at least, which is sort of notably set with some sort of disastrous thing happening at sea. And obviously, he himself would have been familiar if he travelled to England and back again. Would have known what a horrible, you know, I imagine a fairly difficult sea crossing was like. And this whole thing of being buried at sea, which of course, you know, that was the only option if you died at sea. And the idea of, it's also kind of a romantic thing, isn't it? Because Shelley died at sea, didn't he? And I don't think he was actually buried at sea, but he definitely died at sea. So I just wonder if he's sort of imagining this kind of, sort of halfway between life and death and between heaven and hell. And he sort of hit on this interesting but kind of ideal metaphor for that.
To what extent do you think this is a romantic poem, David? Do you think this could fit into that broad umbrella label?
I mean, he's definitely moving away from... It feels too sort of baroque, I suppose. Is that the word?
It's a great word.
For the romantics. So he's finding his own voice much more effectively here. I don't know. I mean, do we know much about? Do we know when exactly this was written?
1831. So he would have been 22.
Yeah. So he's sort of looking to, as I say, kind of find his own voice a bit here. So it's obviously it's not because I think at least one of the poems in this collection that I've got is included in one of the stories. It features right in the middle of the fall of the House of Usher, and I just wondered if perhaps this was the same situation. But I guess if he wrote it that early on, then probably not. But it I wondered perhaps if there was a sort of context around it, you know, a kind of fictional context around it to help explain a bit more about
it's linked,
where it comes from.
It's linked somehow, it says on this website I'm looking at the poem on, it's linked to Ligeia.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. I can't remember anything about that story.
But not written at the same time. So okay. This is an earlier poem, but it was published later. It wasn't published at the time, I don't think. And when it got published, it was linked to Ligeia for some reason.
I may just very quickly say that in Alan Tait has written quite a brief introduction, and one of the things he says is that... I just noticed he's got the same name, Alan. He says that Poe, one of the things he did was he wrote a lot of poems early, but he revised them constantly. Yeah. So it may be, Rob, that you say this is 1831 or whatever you said.
Yeah.
It may be that this might have been a version that was a decade later or something, I don't know, that he added to or revised in some way. But regardless of that, so you're saying maybe it's a single from a bigger album.
Well, who knows? I mean, that was kind of what Martin pointed out about Darkness, wasn't it? Last time, was that actually we needed to consider it
as part of a wider
in
book,
the context of yeah, exactly, as part of a kind of wider.
Martin said it was like listening to Money without listening to the whole of Dark Side of the Moon.
Very good. Did Martin say that?
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe this is the same. Maybe this is just like listening to track 3 from a Black Sabbath album. quite realizing where
it's,
it fits in.
It's very impassive, it strikes me, this poem in general. He doesn't really seem to have much of a view on it, does he? I mean, it doesn't seem sad, the ending particularly. I'm vaguely wondering about Atlantis. Now we've mentioned Atlantis and Aquaman and Warlords of Atlantis, whether this has got anything to do with the Atlantis myth, whether he's describing the sinking of Atlantis, which was a sort of culture, a dead culture, the lost continent idea, whether this has got a sort of relationship to that in a way.
I would say that is an absolutely brilliant shout. I don't know, of course, whether it's in Poe's mind or not, but I was rather idly asking you to speculate on cities beneath the sea, and we never actually really properly hit upon the fact that there is this myth of Atlantis, which was absolutely huge in the 19th century, I think.
Yeah, and isn't the myth of Atlantis as well that it was dead before it was taken by the waves, or am I just inventing that to make this poem make more sense?
I think there's various permutations on the Atlantis thing, because I think that it's in Plato, one of his whatever books that I haven't read in its entirety, but there's a couple of passages in the Timaeus and one of the other ones that he talks about. There is a reason for me saying this, by the way. He talks about an ancient story that he'd heard from his great grandfather. This is one of the characters talking to Plato, not Plato himself. I think they're talking to Socrates in the setup for the book. And he says, let's say my great grandfather, he himself had travelled or knew someone who travelled to Egypt and was told the story of the war against the Atlanteans and how 9,000 years ago the city went beneath the waves and so on. And then I think ever since then, throughout, you know, sort of occultism in the Renaissance and thereafter, there's different permutations on the Atlantis myth, whether, all of this stuff, the earlier world, the superior technology, the occult mysteries and stuff. So the specifics of any given rendering of the Atlantis tale seem to be manipulated according to the context in which Atlantis is being presented.
Gotcha, yeah.
Mm.
But in a way, looking at this poem, I mean, Babylon-like walls, the whole thing's going down under the sea. In a way, if he doesn't have Atlantis somewhere in the back of his mind, I suppose it's surprising.
Yeah,
be a surprise, yeah, wouldn't be there, isn't it?
And what, yeah, Martin thinks.
That we're idiots.
I shouldn't wonder. Well, I really do like that chat, because it hadn't occurred to me. And I don't think necessarily that's the main stay of it, because, like, I'm just really trying to articulate not very well. I think Atlantis is one of those things that it can be many different things to many different, you know, presentations, depending on what you want to get out of it. His doesn't seem to be an obsession with some kind of classical legend at all. It seems to be a far more modern as you said, it could be a metaphor for some take he's got on the modern world rather than a fanciful archaism. But nevertheless, the imagery may be in there. Yeah.
Cool.
Boys, are we going to go on to our next poem?
Let's do it. Let's crack on. Mm.
Yeah.
Right, this is your poem, Rob. I've written down Conqueror Worm. Is that the title of the poem?
It's called The Conqueror Worm, but yeah.
Okay, so where are we at reading on this? Is this you, then me?
Yeah, me, then you, yeah, I think. Okay, this is The Conqueror... Oh, do you want to tap your gong there?
I've got to tap my gong, Rob. Okay, I'll tap my gong and we'll come back with The Conqueror Worm by Edgar Allan Poe.
The Conqueror Worm by Edgar Allan Poe. Lo, 'tis a gala night within the lonesome latter years, an angel throng bewinged, bedight in veils and drowned in tears, sit in a theatre to see a play of hopes and fears, while the orchestra breathes fitfully the music of the spheres. Mimes, in the form of God on high, mutter and mumble low, and hither and thither fly. Mere puppets they, who come and go at bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings invisible woe. That motley drama, oh, be sure it shall not be forgot, with its phantom chased for evermore by a crowd that sees it not, through a circle that ever returneth in to the self-same spot, and much of madness, and more of sin, and horror the soul of the plot. But see, amid the mimic rout, a crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out the scenic solitude. It writhes with mortal pangs, the mimes become its food, and the angels sob at vermin fangs, in human gore imbued. Out are the lights, out all, and over each quivering form the curtain, a funeral pall, comes down with the rush of a storm, and the angels, all pallid and wan, uprising, unveiling, affirm that the play is the tragedy Man, and its hero, the Conqueror Worm.
The Conqueror Worm. Lo, 'tis a gala night within the lonesome latter years, an angel throng, bewinged, bedight in veils and drowned in tears, sit in a theatre to see a play of hopes and fears while the orchestra breathes fitfully the music of the spheres. Mimes in the form of God on high mutter and mumble low and hither and thither fly. Mere puppets they who come and go at bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings invisible woe. That motley drama, oh be sure it shall not be forgot, with its phantom chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not, through a circle that ever returneth into the self-same spot, and much of madness and more of sin and horror the soul of the plot. But see amid the mimic rout a crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out the scenic solitude. It writhes with mortal pangs, the mimes become its food, and seraphs sob at vermin fangs in human gore imbued. Out, out are the lights, out all, and over each quivering form the curtain, a funeral pall, comes down with the rush of a storm, while the angels, all pallid and wan, uprising, unveiling, affirm that the play is the tragedy, man, and its hero, the conqueror worm.
Sweet.
Okay.
Legendary choice.
Thanks.
Yep. Can we now talk about worms in films?
Please do.
It just feels like I think I've got more to offer on that than I have on Cities in the Sea.
I think once you've gone past Jeff Lieberman's 1976 classic Squirm, which is the I believe the only killer worm film I can think of, it's slim pickings.
Isn't there Tremors?
Oh, that's true. They're kind of giant, super toothy worms that live under the
sort of, aren't they? Yeah,
under the desert in like wherever the hell that is, New Mexico somewhere.
The one my personal favourite, I've not seen it for a very long time, is the Lair of the White Worm.
Man, amazing. Ken Russell. That's a hooting classic.
A young Hugh Grant.
That's right.
A young Peter Capaldi.
That's correct. Yeah.
Complete madness.
Hugh Grant, of course, who played Byron.
Yes.
Everything, all roads lead back to Byron.
I mean, this hinges a lot on how serious.
Talking of hinges, can I just say someone's got some sound effects behind them? There's some creaky door hinging.
Oh, it's probably seagulls. I'll close the door.
No. I mean, I just thought it was Poe-esque. I liked it. It was something we haven't actually thought of as a pod, is it? Putting in atmosphere tracks of.
I mean, there may be some creature being ripped to shreds in my front garden, but I'll block out the sound anyway.
No, please don't.
I'm back now.
The Conqueror Worm. What do you make of that one, David?
Well, what the play, or the poem, or the title? Because it strikes me as I was saying the how seriously you take this hinges so much on this image of a conqueror worm, which is, to me at least, quite amusing.
I don't know about that.
I just don't know. I don't know what it means.
Well, it means that no matter what you do in your life, that ultimately you're worm food. The worms always win. The conqueror worm is the inescapable triumph of death over life. Is the
so it's not. It's not like William the Conqueror.
No. What? With a little top hat on and a little Poirot moustache and a sword. No, I'm afraid not. No, I believe the.
Well, it is.
It is in the context of this play, I suppose. But I think what he's saying is that the dramas of human existence are fundamentally incidental and fleeting. and just what is that line up from Shakespeare about, you know, the players that strut in on a stage full of sound and fury, yeah. signifying nothing and all that. You know, I think that's broadly what he's saying here, isn't it? It's that image of we mere puppets who come and go at the bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping around, and you know, we're just existing in all these motley dramas. But the reality is, the ending is always the same, which is that we're worm food and that the worms will always win. You know, I think that's the broad theme of the poem. It's expressed in this kind of peculiar narrative. But I think that's what the metaphor is.
He's kind of ticked off different metaphors, different extended metaphors and conceits through the course of these poems, isn't he? So, yeah, to finish... Well, not finished necessarily his career. I don't know exactly when this was written, but to move on to the theatre is quite interesting. I mean, his parents were actors, weren't they?
That's right.
His parents who died young. Because you mentioned that in King Lear, of course. And maybe that's partly sort of forms his thinking. But yeah, I like this idea that he is, again, sort of frustrated and dissatisfied and unfulfilled with the kind of what phrases does he use, the motley drama. There's a few other examples of just kind of not very good sort of cheap and cheerful theatre.
Well, he's very disparaging because he refers to the actors never as actors. He refers to them either as mimes,
as mimics,
motleys.
The orchestra breathes fitfully the music of the spheres. But actually, so we're not aware, while we're kind of fiddling around being sort of, you know, passing the time with this nonsense, there's a much more powerful, potent tragedy that we're participating in, that we're sort of enacting without realising it.
I mean, you mentioned Black Sabbath. I'm not familiar at all with their work, but what I would say is that the idea that if one had to list the top five poetic themes, I think the idea that, you know, we're all going to return to the dust would probably be amongst that top five, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah,
and done very beautifully in Richard Attenborough's Oscar-winning film Gandhi. Finishes with the birds on the lake, a metaphor, and I think that message is not new to poetry. But what is extraordinary about this, and I mean, my gosh, this is the Corman thing, it's got Vincent Price written all over this poem, hasn't it?
Funnily enough, the reason I've chose this poem is because The Conqueror Worm is a poem I've never read before, never clapped eyes on it. But I chose this because The Conqueror Worm is the title of Witchfinder General in America.
Really? You're kidding.
Yeah, that's what led me, because that's Vincent Price, obviously, in... there's a Civil War thing, but they just take the title. It's got nothing to do with this poem. I slightly wondered if I would have, but no, I don't know why. But they just...
I'm sure it's got everything to do with this poem. I mean, when they were selecting the title, they went down to some copywriters in the department and went, you know, hey, Travis, you got a degree from Cornell. What are we going to call this picture? And he probably said something like, wow, you know, it's Edgar Allan Poe, The Conqueror Worm. Great, Travis. I mean, it's like that, isn't it? I mean, they didn't just take this title by chance.
Scanning
through this book, I've realised that almost every American novel or poet has taken their title from...
Edgar Allan Poe.
He's massive, isn't he? Yeah, that's the thing.
My wife has a large collection of the works of, Paul Theroux, Louis Theroux's dad?
Yeah.
Mm.
And his book about England, of course, is called The Kingdom by the Sea. Again, that's
right.
That's an allusion.
Oh, I've got that kicking around here somewhere. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's Annabelle Lee. That's the bit. That's the Lolita thing.
Yeah.
But throughout this, you see that. So, I mean, what I'm saying, Rob, is obviously when they called it The Conqueror Worm in America, it was an allusion.
It says here, I've just looked it up. It says British horror film Witchfinder General was retitled The Conqueror Worm for US release. Although American International Pictures prints featured a voiceover with Vincent Price in character as Matthew Hopkins reciting The Conqueror Worm, The film is not actually an adaptation of Poe's poem. Now I don't know if I've seen that version, or is that? It must be the normal version. I can't remember it, but yeah, there we go. So it's done as a voiceover. He reads this
incredible
reads this poem,
and you can see why, because this has got a. I mean, it anticipates sort of the cinematic very much.
Yeah, let me just jump in before you get too into that and say probably the reason is that AIP went, oh, look, Vincent Price has had all that success with Edgar Allan Poe stuff with Roger Corman. We've got another Vincent Price picture. Let's link it up with all those other films. give it an Edgar Allan Poe title, because it's just some weird film set in the Civil War about witch hunting.
So it's probably that's going to be a hard sell. This is a historical drama from England in the 17th century.
Exactly. So we'll link it up with those other big splashy, because you know, mid early 60s there would have been quite high profile. Certainly Corman's largest budget films, things like Mask of the Red Death and Fall of the House of Usher, would have been quite big pictures, you know. Really, I think they were like sort of A pictures rather than B pictures, you know.
Yeah, it does say you kind of perhaps don't appreciate this enough, but Poe is massive in America. He's one of their major writers. I think we think of him as a slightly almost as a kind of genre author. But I mean, this what I had up my sleeve as sort of plan B for my my quiz question was, did you know about this? Are you aware that there's only one, as far as anyone is aware, I think, only one sports team in the world whose name is inspired by a work of literature?
Ooh, hold on. Oh, is it the somebody Ravens, like the Baltimore Ravens or something?
That's exactly what it is, yeah. So the Baltimore Ravens.
Oh, come on. Hello. that was a shot in the dark.
The Raven, which is, brilliantly done. And that really goes to show how far his sort of cultural reach is. And I'm pretty confident in saying, I reckon he's the author that's most alluded to in The Simpsons.
Right, yeah.
He crops up a lot. He's got a real kind of, yeah, so it's sort of, although it seems a bit strange that the Americans would switch to a much more abstract title for that film, because that's basically, The Witchfinder General pretty much does tell you what that film's about,
yeah.
Whereas the Conqueror Worm leaves you entirely in the dark. That's a sort of a testament to how huge culturally Poe actually is.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's very much worth pointing out. Because he, what's interesting about this poem, as I was sort of saying, is not the the sentiment itself, but the incredible visual way, as you said, many extended metaphors, many conceits, in which it's realised in this poem, which is very dramatic. And I think it would be wrong not to acknowledge that it's not comic exactly, but it's overwrought,
yeah,
sort of to the extent that it's and there's such a degree of wit and intelligence behind the writing that there is a, if not comic, a slightly kind
I think that's true of the Raven as well. That hysteria, it's got a slight wink.
Which
allows you to get on board with it without it seeming too hysterical. You know.
It's not going. I mean, I'm not going to say anything negative about Christina Rossetti, because she's a very different type of a poet. But her meditation on this theme would have been a lot more sort of sincere and. I don't know. It would have been more earnest in a way, possibly. I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn, because I'm by no means an expert on Christina Rossetti, but other poets would have reflected on the inevitability of death without invoking the lines, "A blood red thing that writhes from out the scenic solitude. It writhes, it writhes with mortal pangs."
Jump back to two lines as well. The way that he directs you in a very entertaining, you know, that is a bit of a film director's flourish, isn't it? "But see, amid the mimic rout, a crawling shape intrude." It's almost like a stage direction, but it's like him pointing at it.
It's more of a screenplay direction, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a cut too.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think what David said, we skirted straight over it because we started talking about the title. But I think when you said that his parents were actors, you know, that he has a familial background in the theatre. I think that probably is really important here. You know, that this is set in a theatre, and the theatre for him is obviously a place of sadness rather than gaiety. You know, it's associated with the death of his parents, you know, and everything that's happened to him subsequently. You know, his entire life has been shaped by this catastrophic double loss. And here we are, which is a poem about the frailty of human existence and the inevitability of our deaths. And, you know, it's a poem which is really concentrated on mortality. You know, we are worm food. And where does he choose to set it? In the theatre. I think that's really important, I suppose, you know.
I think it is, because you're right to observe that is an autobiographical wellspring of, well, I guess, you know, his unhappiness and the demon that haunted him. But there is that. But this poem, in a way, if this was about I lost my parents, I'm sad, tonally it doesn't have that. Tonally it's much more showy and almost entertaining.
Oh, it is entertaining, for definite, yeah. Through that very emphatic declamatory style which he's adopted here, it stops being a sullen, sulky meditation and becomes a kind of a highly engaging little sort of morality play, or not morality play, but a kind of, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think that's good.
You know, a kind of a wry existential statement rather than a kind of a dour meditation on death, you know.
Yeah, and I love all of the images here. I mean, this is the final stanza. It's just absolutely brilliant. Out are the lights, out all. And over each quivering form, the curtain, a funeral pall, comes down with the rush of a storm.
Go back to that romance, and I was saying I don't think the rhymes don't satisfy. Here they absolutely do. Those four lines you just read, you know, the way that... You know, over each quivering form, the curtain of funeral pall comes down with a rush of a storm. You know, the meter and precision of that feels really satisfying.
Which is so different. Sorry, go on.
And that's true all the way through the poem. I just feel like he's really on top of the form here. So that it gallops along in this really rhythmic kind of incantatory style. And it just sort of delivers image after image in this really satisfying rhythmic way. This to me is the best of these three poems by a very wide margin.
Well, yeah, because it not only has he finally arrived at his the territory that is most sort of familiar to him, you know, and familiar to us as far as what we know about Poe is concerned. It feels like this is his home ground now.
Yeah, mature style.
And also, but also he's the what I find really interesting about Poe is that as a short story writer, those stories they're great in many, many ways. They're fantastically interesting as far as the ideas. They're incredibly, incredibly vivid, obviously. They're really quite ahead of their time in many ways. But they are not easy to read. I don't know if you've ever attempted to read a Poe short story out loud, but my God, those sentences drag along the page. Right. I mean, they really clunk. You know, he does not do brevity. And he does not, you know, he does not vary his sentence lengths. And it's really interesting, I think, that he hits thematically. He's dealing with the same stuff that he deals with in most of those stories, certainly the most famous ones in this poem. But he's because he's got the sort of discipline of the poetic form here, and you know, as we've mentioned, the Raven. He's able to express those ideas like this. So much more sort of delicately and precisely and sort of technically with that kind of technical kind of...
It's the direct condensation of poetry, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
just in light of what you've just said, the paragraph, I'm not going to read you, I'm only going to read you one sentence. The paragraph before the one I read you about procrastination in The Imp of the Perverse, a sentence that says, "There lives no man who at some period has not been tormented, for example, by an earnest desire to tantalise a listener by a circumlocution. Mm, yeah. The speaker is aware that he displeases. He has every intention to please. He is usually curt, precise and clear. The most laconic and luminous language is struggling for utterance upon his tongue. It is only with difficulty that he restrains himself from giving it flow," etc., etc. And he talks about the deliberate circumlocution to annoy people. Anyway, that's just... On what you said, but I mean, he in this poem, I think you're right. This is Poe, isn't it?
Yeah. This feels like his mature style that's developed fully. I mean, just very very quickly to jump on the technical stuff a little bit. There's only three rhymes for each 8-line stanza, so it's A B A B. So where's it go? A B A B C B C B. So you get years, tears, fears, spheres, high, fly, low, go, fro, woe. So that's, I think, what gives it that really rhythmic structure. So the A line, the A rhyme becomes a C, but the B is continuous all the way through. So it goes...
I'm gonna quietly mutter Ottavo Reimer under my breath and look at my shoes and hope I'm not wrong.
I think you are quite wrong, but maybe, I don't know.
It's definitely Ottava, but it's not... I don't think it's got the same... I can't remember exactly what the Ottava Reimer actually does. I'm fairly sure it's sort of symmetrical, more so than this. But I may be wrong, and of course we know exactly who's going to get in touch to tell us. Yeah.
This I think is a really engaging and very direct. It feels very direct and lucid, whilst still being a pretty bizarre visionary piece of kind of Gothic art. But it feels far more direct than those other two, and far more engaging. I like this poem a good deal.
It's an unforgettable masterpiece. Yeah.
Bedight is an unusual word. What does bedight mean? Like,
That's a good question.
Bedecked, is it? I mean,
It says adorned.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so bedecked. I suspect he's cheated there and invented a word to fit with the rhyme.
Yeah.
Sorry if that's not the case. Apologies to him. But yeah, it's fine. Well, nothing wrong with that, obviously.
Maybe there will be some Poe listeners in America who can get back to us on that.
We should probably also fleetingly just point out that once again, three randomly chosen poems, we've got two sets of condor wings.
Yeah.
Evidently, the condor was a meaningful bird for Poe.
Would you like to hear what Alan Tate says in his notes about the condor?
Very much, please.
He says,
say Darkness by Byron, by any chance?
CF.
The one thing that Alan Tate's read, apart from the poem.
He says, if any of Alan Tate's relations are listening, or Alan Tate himself, although this book was published in the 60s, I think, I'm sure we are mindful that Alan Tate has read a lot, because this is a brilliant edition, I'm enjoying it. He says that a condor, and he just says, "hideous vulture, brackets, who cannot rise from the earth by itself," end brackets.
Nice.
Now, Rob, I don't need to ask you who starred in Condor Man, do I?
Oh, that was, Betty, Michael Crawford, of course.
And I guess this is a zoological, ornithological fact, that the condor has to go up to a high place and sort of jump off.
Well, that would be perfect then, because obviously we're talking about these mere puppets, these humans who are just land, you know, earthbound, tragic earthbound things. They can never elevate themselves, nor can they escape their situation. They're there, and bear in mind, they're characterized here as mimes, so they're just in dumb show, but they are in the form of God on high, as in man is created in the image of his creator. So they've got this godlike form, but actually they've got these condor wings. They may appear godly, but actually they're just these kind of useless appendages which are never going to be able to lift them off. You know, they're just, you know, struggling in dumb show for their whole lives, waiting essentially to be eaten by worms. Well, the line that has interested me actually, this that motley drama, "Oh, be sure it shall not be forgot," with its phantom chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not. I wonder what that phantom is there.
That motley drama, "Oh, be sure it shall not be forgot," with its phantom chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not. Okay, can I have a crack at that?
Do it.
I mean, the motley drama is the drama of human history, right? I mean, there's no other way of
absolutely
seeing it. It's, but also, I mean, this is where, I mean, I think David was saying about it condenses things, because it's partly it's human history, but it's also just the lives that have been lived.
Yeah.
"Oh, be sure it shall not be forgot," with its phantom, i.e. its kind of, its memory, its traces, chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not. So I think it condenses both the idea that you can think about other people's lives. They may be people who you knew, they're now dead, or they've done something, or it could be from history, you know, that we've studied these great men and women of the past. And you know, the motley drama is constantly being chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not. They'll never get to their imagined, idealized ideas about what life was, whether it was loyalty, whether it was valor, whether it was romantic love, whatever it was that people think life was about.
Yeah, I mean, it's also the next line there is with its phantom chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not, through a circle that ever returneth in to the self same spot. So it's just
he's taken, as you rightly pointed out, Macbeth, act 5, scene whatever it is, 5, the strutting players.
Yeah.
He's taken that and he's reimagined it in a new, quite complex and dense metaphor.
Yeah.
Because I think through a circle that ever returneth into the self-same spot is that same idea.
Full of thunder fury signifying nothing, yeah.
Although the crowd are chasing after it, it's basically a circle that keeps coming back to the self-same spot. And what they meet on their journey around the circumference of this circle is madness, more of sin, and horror, the soul of the plot. A brilliant rhyme, yeah. With not there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. I mean, yeah. I think the connection to Macbeth is actually quite strong there in terms of what he's saying about.
Or is the phantom God? And bear in mind, we've just come from that last paragraph, last sentence. I mean, that'd be a very cynical attitude to take. It would almost surprise me from something so, sort of, you know, from this period, but. You know, he's just talked about mimes in the form of God on high, mutter and mumble low, and hither and thither fly. You know, this is, as we were saying, just the kind of the trivial doings of humanity. Mere puppets they, who come and go at the bidding of vast formless things. So again, they're just sort of manipulated by these kinds of unseen influences and forces that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings. So that motley drama, "Oh, be sure it shall not be forgot," with its phantom chased forevermore. So isn't that we are trying to unpick the nature of the meaning of our lives, you know, to try and discover God or truth or, you know, and that is the phantom, the great unknowable things of our existence, these sort of big existential questions. So But by this crowd that sees it not, we'll never know any of this stuff, and we'll always just be in this state of continuous unknowing, and sort of the suspension of, you know, of any development that we could ever have, because there'll always be this kind of central void in our lives, the phantom. Mm.
And it's even worse than that, isn't it? Because when we're faced with the final curtain, ultimately we'll be quivering with terror, because you know the sort of the realization of of the reality of what's to come. So yeah, I think that's pretty consistent with the rest of his output as far as any kind of attitude towards God is concerned. I don't think he was a believer.
Yeah,
he certainly wasn't. If he was, he certainly was a very doubtful one.
Yeah,
I think you've done this podcast a service with drilling down onto that idea. But I think you've also done poetry a service.
Oh, well, of course. Don't mention it. Don't mention it, poetry.
is there a knighthood in this?
Yeah, I think
because I think that a sentient reader would look at this, and one of the questions that they would ask is, well, okay, all right, we all die. What have you got to say about the spiritual life, you know, that some of us believe in, some of us don't? And he has got something to say about that, as you have just rightly said. So I think Phantom, I don't think that my own take on it in the sense that Phantom means it's not really there, doesn't it? It's an invisible thing that people are chasing. It could be, as I was saying, the values of human life that we place on things. But I think he's also there saying, absolutely, and there is other religious imagery in here, isn't there? The angels, etc. So I think you're right about... He's treating, you know, with those four lines, he's treating not just the values that human will and mind places on things, but also he's treating a kind of the idea of God and the spiritual dimension as well.
Yeah.
And I think the reason I say you've done poetry service is because I think, you know, that's one of the many reasons that, I mean, maybe I'm getting a bit carried away, but I think that does actually make this a really, really successful and brilliant work of a great poet.
Yeah. What is the music of the spheres? That's something I've heard a lot about, but I don't know really what it is. Is that just that?
I'll hand that one over to David.
Thanks. It's definitely, I'm sure that crops up in Shakespeare, doesn't it? I can't think. Maybe it's in The Tempest. I mean, isn't it just, it's a sort of celestial kind of God-given soundtrack almost.
Right.
I think. I'm really just flapping around there, though, to be honest.
This is another one for Martin, isn't it? I think it is a Renaissance idea that probably comes out of, you know, Catholicism, about the sort of cosmic order and someone at some point set down the phrase.
I've got it here, I've just googled it. It says the musica universalis, literally universal music, also called the music of the spheres or the harmony of the spheres, is an ancient philosophical concept that regards proportions in the movements of celestial bodies, the sun, moon and the planets, as a form of music.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wasn't alien to sort of the theology of monasticism and medieval thought, as well as a Renaissance.
No, it's much. It's like from ancient Greece, in fact. Pythagoras and his followers thought that celestial bodies make music. So it goes back a long old way, the music of the spheres. Mm. Anyway, I won't bore you with that, but it's interesting. So he's basically saying the orchestra breathes fitfully this kind of the mechanical workings of the universe that is also the sort of thing that an orchestra would do, which is music.
I mean, this is the fulfilment of the promise he laid down in the first poem, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Gentlemen, we've gone over 2 hours margin. I'm going to ring my gong and then I'm going to ask you for some summative thoughts on Poe. And then finally, perhaps, Rob, you'll read out our email address to anyone who would like to correspond.
Absolutely. Okay?
Okay, well, thank you both very much for joining me this evening to talk about Edgar Allan Poe, this extremely important American poet, and evidently, as we've discovered, I think, this evening, to English literature in general. You know, we've already basically said it. I mean, I've said my opinion. I think this poem is, I mean, all of the poems I've enjoyed enormously. This is the most fully realised of them and the most entertaining. He is it's difficult for me, and I guess for you guys as well, but certainly for myself, who doesn't have a huge knowledge of all the other poetry that's ever been written, to say whether he's new or not, whether he's breaking ground or not. But it seems to me that he's taken the influence of Byron and he's done his own thing, for possibly for the autobiographical and the reasons that he had, and that he was unhappy. But he has produced incredible and clearly highly influential work. That's me done, boys.
Yeah, what you said. Yeah, I won't argue any of those points. I think that's true. Yeah, as I say, the end of every single podcast, it's encouraged me to dive a bit further into the poetry. As we said at the start, I know the short stories fairly well, not all of them intimately, but across the whole output, I feel like I've rather read them all, or 90% of them. The poetry is a blank spot, really. So I'll definitely dip in and have a further investigation into these poems. This last one has really impressed me. I really like it. I really love it, in fact. They're all very entertaining. And I look forward to reading more. David.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we often seem to do, we've sort of hit on three kind of almost ideal examples, really, haven't we, that sort of plot his sort of progression, his sort of evolution as a writer. I mean, I think
more by luck than judgment, it should be pointed
out. Yeah,
I mean,
that's
completely random.
Out quite neatly. I suppose most great writers do kind of successfully carve out a unique kind of niche for themselves within what they, whatever medium they choose to use. And I think Poe is one of the, he really does occupy a place on the shelf kind of to himself. And it's really interesting, I think, because I wasn't really familiar with Poe the poet, it has been really interesting to sort of marry up the Gothic author, that, this kind of pioneer of a really kind of particular and interesting and enduring form of fiction, and to see how he's got there within poetry, to see how he sort of found a voice and found a way to express those ideas within poetry, as well as within the short fiction that we know a bit better. So yeah, it's been a really enlightening experience.
Good.
Well, good. Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
To the exercise, isn't it? Well, hopefully the listeners will find it just the same.
Rob, do invite our listeners.
We would love to hear from you if you're listening to this, even if it's just to say hello. But by all means, if you've got suggestions or recommendations or requests for poets you'd like to hear covered, we are absolutely open to do requests, and you can sort of push us in the directions you'd like to hear more about. The email address to send to is poetrypodcats. That's poetrypodcats, like the animal, CATS, @gmail.com. poetrypodcats@gmail.com. Please do write in.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Well, thank you again for joining us for the Poetry and English Literature podcast. I will, as I customarily do, reach over, find my little bowl. I seem to have temporarily lost the thing that I hit it with, so I might have to... Oh, here it is. And we will hopefully be joined by your listenership in our next episode, whenever that may be. Thank you, David and Robin, very much for joining me on the Poetry and English Literature podcast, considering Edgar Allan Poe.
Cheers, fellas.
Yep, cheers.